You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes.
Today, we are joined by Anton Bittel for a discussion of Eraserhead. David Lynch's first film, released in 1977, has, over time, become a cult classic of contemporary cinema. It originally gained notoriety as a midnight movie, attracting the attention of artists such as Stanley Kubrick, H.R. Giger, and Mel Brooks. Difficult or nearly impossible to summarize because of its complex surrealist imagery and themes, the film follows Henry Spencer, who learns that his girlfriend Mary is expecting a baby. The child turns out to be a monstrous creature, constantly crying, always in need of feeding, and prone to getting sick. Mary cannot tolerate the situation and leaves them. Meanwhile, Henry experiences visions of an angel-like lady in his radiator and progressively becomes more antagonistic towards the baby. Shot in a sharply contrasting black and white, immersed in a powerful soundscape, nightmarish and hypnotic, Eraserhead continues, 50 years after its release, to entrance viewers. And each rewatch seems to reveal something new of note. But beyond the nightmare, one must remember that in heaven, everything is fine.
Anton Bittel is a freelance film critic specializing in horror cinema. He contributes regularly to Sight and Sound, Little White Lies, Sci-Fi Now, and his own site, projectedfigures.com, as well as to home video labels like Arrow, Second Sight, and Umbrella. He also programs for the London Korean Film Festival.
Hello, welcome, Anton Bittel. We're delighted to have you with us today for a discussion of David Lynch's Eraserhead.
Hello, it's good to be here. Really always love talking about this film.
Fantastic. Could you get us started by telling us a little bit about what context you first saw the film and also why you chose it today? What does Eraserhead mean to you?
Okay, well, it came out in 1977 and rather giving my age away, I was seven then. So obviously I didn't see it when it was first released, which would have been practically impossible in Australia anyway. Actually, it would have taken several years to get there because of the nature of its distribution, which was rather unusual. But in 1977, Star Wars came out, which, although it seems odd to me to look back on now, was the beginning of my interest in cinema. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw Eraserhead probably when I was 15 or 16, so sort of, let's say, the mid-80s. And that was the next turning point, I think, in my kind of adventure in cinema. And that, much more than Star Wars, is the one that has stayed with me ever since. I think Eraserhead completely transformed my idea of what cinema can be and what it can do. And it's also a film which I've seen, especially in the first 20 years after seeing it, I just watched again and again and again. I've probably seen, let's say, 50 times. And I feel that it's a film that actually does grow with you. It's not a static film because it doesn't give itself away, and therefore you're always projecting a bit of yourself onto it. And it has really, since, let's say, the second time I saw it, I think it has consistently remained, I'm not really sure what it means to say what your favorite film is, but it certainly has remained one of my favorite films. And I think when people ask me what my favorite film is, this is typically the one that I will say in reply. Mm-hmm. So I've lived with this film for a very, very long time. And it's now 50 years old. This is its 50th anniversary. In part because of what we're doing now, I've revisited it several times recently, which I hadn't done for a while. Hmm. It's an awful thing to say, but it still holds up in that it feels utterly mystifying. And I must say that there've been stages in my viewing of this film where I thought, I get it now. I know what this film's doing. I don't think I could say that now. I feel that I've lost that, and I'm quite happy with that because part of the kind of joy of this film is getting lost in it and not really understanding what it's doing to you. I think David Lynch, very typically when he's asked about this film or any of his films really, is extremely oblique. He doesn't like explaining his films. He feels that that's left to the viewer. And while that can be very frustrating, at the same time, it's liberating because it really is putting the onus on us to take from this film whatever we can or whatever we wish to project onto it what we desire. And I mean, that's why I love this film, because there is no authoritative account of what it's doing. It's just there, and you have to deal with it in some way or another. And if you enjoy the film, which I fully accept not everybody will. I don't think I love this film, but I don't think there are lots of people I would not recommend this film to because I just don't think it would be for them. But if you engage with this film, it's very rewarding trying to work your way through the questions that it's posing. It's not really posing questions, but it's mystifying itself. I think that's the way I would put it.
In what way has your understanding of the film evolved with the years?
Well, I think at some point I thought it was entirely about an artist's creative process. And I still do, in part, think that's true, but I think there's many more angles to it. I've also wavered quite a lot on, I mean, I don't really like to get hung up on, I'm not a border cop, and I don't like to get hung up on kind of questions of genre. But this film's always presented as a horror film, and it's always struck me as a very inadequate characterization of it. It has horror elements in it. I mean, I'm not going to dispute that, but it's so much more. It's also a romance, if you want to call that. You could even call it a romantic comedy if you really wish to. And I feel that my kind of the way that my brain tries to categorize it, which has never been monolithic anyway, shifts over time. And I also find that Henry becomes a more, I want to say a more comic figure as I get older, although I think actually that was always there.
Oh, it's interesting that you say that because I love the Keaton-esque or the slapstick physical aspects to the film. And I have the sense, even though, my reading on Eraserhead has not been exhaustive, but I get the sense that that is a rather overlooked aspect of the film. And particularly for a film that has so little dialogue, do you think that these links with silent cinema, that that's one point of engagement that is perhaps overlooked or one that you appreciate particularly?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not just almost no dialogue, but also the fact that it's presented in monochrome. And I mean, quite now, a lot of films are black and white, but actually, when that came out, it was really, really unusual for a film still to be made in monochrome. In fact, I think I remember reading somewhere that Lynch had to go to quite great lengths to get the film stock for it. And yeah, I mean, particularly when we first meet him on Earth, if I can put it that way, before the opening sequence. The first encounter with him, where he's kind of engulfed in the landscape, he's this little man in an overwhelming, alienating environment. And then when we see him walk along, and of course he steps in the puddle. These are all sort of classic pratfalls from, as you say, silent comedies like Keaton. He's also quite Tati-esque because he's so fussy. He's just such a fussy character, and he always looks like he's in the wrong time. And so yeah, no, I absolutely think that there's a lot of comic touches, and I think they do continue throughout. I mean, for example, one of the most grotesque and bizarre sequences in the film, although there really are a lot, it's weird to single one out, but the scene where he's decapitated and his head is taken to a pencil factory and literally turned into erasers, is played completely for laughs. The kind of interaction between the man at the front desk, Paul, and the boss who comes in and shouts at him is just ridiculously over the top in the way that it's played. And it's really and I think one of the things that I like about the film is that it presents you with this kind of weird mismatch of responses. There are scenes that are openly comic and where they are funny and you do laugh, but they'll be coupled with something that's absolutely repellent and grotesque. And trying to find your way through these dissonances is part of the pleasure of the film. In fact, the whole film is like that. And I mean, Lynch famously sort of, when he talks about his films, he talks about mood and vibe. And actually, although those are unquantifiable, it is a very good way of looking at the film. I never really know what to do with it because it's such vague language. But this is a film that gives you feelings that are unfamiliar and that you don't really know. You don't know how to analyze your own response to the film because everything that's being thrown at you is not just strange, but also mismatched, incongruous is what I would say.
But talking, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm done.
But talking about this moment when Henry's head is used to create the erasers, which seems to be central to the film, because after all, that's the title of the film. What do you make of it? If the head of Henry is erasing, what is it erasing? What is the body writing, in a sense?
Okay. Well, I mean, the title, there's kind of a lot of flirtation, I think, with the title. We first see Mary X, his ex-girlfriend, in a little photo that he has clearly, in anger, cut in two, so that her head is in a separate part of the photo from her shoulders. And I think that's the arguably the first time that the title is kind of played out because he has erased her head. And we then, there's a cutaway to the real Mary, who's framed by the window of her house or her parents' house. No, it's her house, in such a way that again, her head seems to be disembodied. Of course, I mean, I should say there is an earlier time when the title is played out, which is the very opening shot when he's almost a disembodied head floating in the air. And what the sequence with Mary shows is his ability to, his capacity, let's say, to destroy things from his past, and to erase things, which is not always successful because with Mary, for example, she comes back into his life when he thinks he's dismissed her from his life. And when it comes to his head falling off, first of all, it's not just that his head falls off, it's replaced, because his baby's head or a baby's head appears where his human head was, and cries like the baby always does. And I guess that's supposed to imply something like that the baby is within him. The baby, whatever it is, and part of the challenge of the film is to work out what the baby is. When we're first told about it, we're told they're not even sure it is a baby. So the status of the baby is always in question, and when you see it, it also is because it doesn't look like what we'd think of as a baby. And in that sequence, when the baby grows out of him, it's an intimation that the baby comes from within him. It is a part of him. And of course, the film opens with the fetus-like object emerging from his mouth or from his head. So it is always something that's born out of him. As for the use made of his head, I think, again, that shows that the imaginative side of him, his brain, is good for erasing things. His struggle is that he's not very creative, and he wants to dream of something new or something that will allow him to escape from all the elements of his environment, which in all of his dreams they're always reconstituted and shown in some kind of form entering his dreams. He wants to escape that, but he can never get rid of them. But what he's always trying to do is to get rid of them and to erase them. And I guess the other anxiety that's being expressed by that particular dream, and I am going to call it a dream, is that he imagines that the contents of his head aren't just there to create or to think, but they're commodifiable by others, that there are others who can exploit and make use of what he does with his imagination, which I think, given the very long gestation of this film, must have been something that was on his mind as he was trying to get this film finished, and was struggling to put money together and didn't know who was going to own the film when it was finished. There were questions about that. And so I guess I guess that is what I would say. But it is also just a really funny gag because you wonder why a film is called Eraserhead, and then it gives you the most literal answer you could possibly have, which is the last thing you ever expect.
And speaking of heads, I was really struck watching the film yesterday for the first time since I finished the third season of Twin Peaks, looking at how some of these motifs have come full circle into Twin Peaks season three. I assume that you've watched that and you may be appreciative of it as well.
I
Yes.
have watched it once
Okay.
when it first showed. So I couldn't, I have seen it, but I'm not going to have the familiarity with it that you do. But no, please tell me.
It's just really interesting. I think some of the motifs that recur in terms of a giant floating head. There are others as well. And I link those actually to this strand of The Wizard of Oz, which disappointingly in the documentary about Lynch and Oz, we don't really discuss this very much. But I think at the beginning of Eraserhead, this pulling of the levers, the kind of machinations that happen in relationship to this giant head are very interesting. And they kind of take us back to this facade of the wizard and his projected head. And that's something that we see again in Twin Peaks season three. So there are a lot of interesting connections there coming back. And I think also the kind of artisanal aspect, which is always present in Lynch's films, but I think the object construction that he did on season three of Twin Peaks in terms of the furniture construction, et cetera, and then the sculptural aspect that's really visible in Eraserhead are things that I really appreciate. And it felt like almost two ends of the spectrum, but really coming full circle in terms of certain cinematic references and also artistic approaches.
But I guess the question that could come after this is, to what extent do you think that Eraserhead is unique within Lynch's filmography, or in what way did it influence the rest of his work?
Well, I mean, actually, I think that in certain respects, Eraserhead is certainly looking back into his previous three short films. I mean, in a very, I don't want to overstate the connections, but there are little jokey references that he puts in. Oh, You Are Sick is obviously a reference to Six Men and Getting Sick. The fact that his apartment is number 26 is an allusion to the alphabet. And both films feature a grandmother who doesn't seem to be quite a human character. And so I think when Lynch made this film, he was certainly looking back on his past career. And there's also another film that he didn't make, which I think is rather important to Eraserhead and to the formation of Eraserhead. As for looking forward, I get, there, I mean, there are so many elements in this that recur in his later films. The zigzag pattern in the lobby floor, which really is taken from or is from Jean Cocteau's Orphée, I think is a direct allusion to Jean Cocteau's Orphée, certainly reappears in Twin Peaks, and I think in one or two other Lynch films. The fixation on lights going out, lights arcing, electricity arcing, is going to be a recurrent motif. And obviously, I mean, and more generally, the sort of dreamlike nature of his narratives. In this, I mean, in this, in Eraserhead, it's very hard to articulate this because I would say that a little bit like Carl Theodor Dreyer's Vampyr, this is a film which, well, Vampyr begins with a man arriving at an inn and falling asleep. And the rest of the film is a series of dreams and a series of dreams within dreams and a series of dreams within dreams. But it never actually returns to its starting point, which is a very disorienting effect. Although, like Eraserhead, it ends in brilliant white. Like the darkness of everything that's preceded is enlightened, if one can put it that way, illuminated. In Eraserhead, I don't even think we're shown the point where the dreaming starts. He appears to be dreaming from the beginning of the film. The initial scenes where he's on Earth and where he stumbles around and first goes to his apartment and is told that he has to meet with Mary X, It's easy to take those as the kind of the grounding part of the narrative, but actually what precedes them makes that a very difficult reading. And so it's not just that we're watching something that's kind of vaguely oneiric and has some dream sequences. I think we're left never really knowing where the starting point is, except that it begins with a birth. It begins with a kind of symbolic, the birth of an idea, and that idea is turned into something material, or rather, it's thrust into the material world by this demiurgic figure, what do they call him, the man in the planet, played by Jack Fisk, who operates levers, is hideously burn scarred. We don't really know why. He's a kind of a mutated, monstrous figure. And somehow the birth takes place before he starts pulling the levers. But once he pulls the levers, that's the moment at which the fetus-like object crashes down to earth and lands in the puddle, and that puddle will then recur a number of times throughout the film. I do think, though, there's an important visual cue in that opening sequence. When we see Henry's head floating at first on the side and then straight on, and there is what we will understand shortly is a planet behind it that aligns with his head. It is actually, I'm quite sure, an allusion to 2001: A Space Odyssey, but with the difference being that instead of this being a film about man's journey into outer space, it's a story about a man, his journey into sort of an inner space, so an imaginative realm. Actually, there's also another really funny reference to openings of films. It's the most improbable reference, but when you see after the fetus falls into the puddle, and then you see a shot from inside the hole, which floats across the screen. So it's a circle floating across an otherwise black screen, and it's the beginning of every James Bond movie. It's the bullet hole, which I think is just really funny because it's so daft. Anyway, and then we emerge from that hole, and that is the final birth of this idea into the material world, and it's the materiality that ties Henry down, that stops him from getting wherever it is he wants to go, because he's always being held back by the decay and the inherently decadent nature of realized materiality. Whether that's his circumstances, the nature of where he lives, the nature of his environment, all of which is decaying. Rather oddly, Lynch himself, his father was a worked for the Forest Commission. He moved a lot when he was a child, but he was always living near greenery. I mean, it's rather important to his upbringing that he grew up near forests, within walking distance of forests, because his father would walk to work. And you would never get even a hint of that in this film. You do see plant life, but I say plant life, you see plants, but they're all dead. You don't see a single living plant in this film. He has a pile of dirt placed on his bedside table with a kind of branch sticking out of it that's a very dead plant. It looks like it's meant to be a pot plant, but it's as dead can be. And so, I mean, in many ways, this film is representing a world that's the very opposite of the world where Lynch himself grew up. Although he's always himself said, and this is something that's unusual when he makes such an explicit comment about the content of his film, he's always insisted that it's his Philadelphia story, that this world is meant to reflect the experiences and that he had and the mood that he felt when he was living in a really rundown area of Philadelphia with a high crime rate, and where he said he spent most of his time in fear. I mean, he was constantly afraid and anxious just because he felt it was a hostile and dangerous environment. And I mean, that is certainly something that you do feel in the kind of little hermetic world of Henry. I guess the only place in the film where he has any kind of comfort is in his room and the warmth that comes from the radiator, and that opens up a different world for him. Although even that world is interpenetrated by the things he's trying to put behind him. He can never really fully get rid of them.
Could we link that perhaps to Lynch's
infamous statement that it's his most spiritual film, but then he wouldn't elaborate on that. And I know that also, as some of the kind of founding mythology of the film, there's a reference to the Bible where he kind of randomly flips to a passage and works with that.
And also maybe to the fact that the baby's mother is named Mary.
Yes, although there's such a actually, maybe I'll get back to the name Mary in a minute. I'll answer the first question, although I'm not going to answer it because I honestly don't know how to answer it. I mean, and when he says it's his most spiritual film, I mean, I do think that this film, I mean, literally coincides with the period where he discovered transcendental meditation. So he himself had a kind of spiritual awakening. And the film is a it tracks a gradual shift from darkness to blinding light. It ends in this blinding light. It's illumination. And it's not hard to see in that something like a representation of the spiritual awakening that Lynch himself had. He has also talked about, I mean, this is less spiritual or more geographical, but he's also commented on how dark it was living in Philadelphia. And the day he arrived for the first day he woke up actually in California, because he arrived at night. And he said he was the light, you know, the effect, the impact that the light of the sky had on him, which he hadn't seen for so long. And I think that also you can argue is reflected in the transition of the film from dark to lightness. Well, if he has a spiritual awakening, and if he, as we know, introduced the whole aspect of the lady in the radiator after he discovered transcendental meditation, this was something new that he brought to his own materials. So we should say the film took like 5.5 years to make. So, and with quite lengthy periods where he couldn't work on it because he didn't have any money. So it really, really had an extremely long development. And Lynch himself changed as he was making this film, and he changed the script as well. In the original script, I believe it ended with the baby consuming him. And he had an idea about the lady in the radiator. I think it started with a squiggle he did, and then developed this entire subplot involving her. And she is where the film ends and adds a completely different dimension to the film. I mean, she gives the film what I guess we call a happy ending. She certainly gives it a Hollywood ending, although in the most un-Hollywood of contexts. I have no idea which passage of the Bible he has in mind. I mean, it could be "Let there be light." It could be anything, you know. There's so many possibilities. I could not claim to be a biblical expert either. But as for the name Mary, I mean, the name Mary is resonant of so many things. Because Mary Henry is the name of the main character in Carnival of Souls, which, as well as being monochrome, as well as featuring, this is going to sound negatively critical, but it's certainly not meant this way. It features a very similar style of kind of blank or unnatural acting, where the line deliveries, they don't feel natural, and they're not robotic, but they're a bit blank. And it's also a film set in a kind of liminal limbo between life and death. I suspect, I don't know whether those are enough of a link to show that this is what Lynch was thinking of, and of course we can't ask him now, but I have always wondered whether that, I mean, I don't think I'm the first to point out that that name almost certainly comes from that. But in fact, the names Mary and Henry were already in another film that he was working on, which he never made. And it's really actually worth talking about this because it's interesting. When he first arrived at the AFI, I think it was in 1970 or maybe 1971, his first project, so in the first year that he was there, was to make a short film called Garden Back. And in that, there was a couple called Mary and Henry, so they had the same names as the couple in Eraserhead. I think the husband strays, and his adultery is kind of embodied in a monstrous insect creature. That's about all we know about it because the film was never made. There have been hints that have been given by various people as to what it was about, but you know, it's hard to be sure. And although this was intended to be a short, at some point some people at AFI looked at the script and they said, there's a horror movie in this. And I think a studio even became interested, and he was offered quite a bit of money to develop it, or promised quite a lot of money if it were developed, let's say. And so embarked upon this. So he was quite happy with this idea as a short, but then he was asked to turn it into a feature-length film and to add a bunch of new scenes and to make it more like a conventional horror film with a monster in it. And the more that Lynch worked on this over that year, the more disaffected he became and the more unhappy he was with the, he just didn't feel that he recognized the project anymore. And it's while he was trying to finish this, because he was under a huge amount of pressure to get it done, that he came up with the idea of Eraserhead. And it's clear that there's a certain, because of the common names of some of the characters, it's not hard to see how one idea is born out of the other. And the reason I think this is important is that one, I don't think there is only one interpretation of Eraserhead, but one complexion that you can place upon it is this notion that Lynch is working through the idea that he has this baby and the baby's gone a bit wrong, and that baby is Gardenback. He loved it when it was born, and it's a bit deformed. He doesn't really recognize what it is anymore. He's a bit freaked out by it. He doesn't really like it anymore. He's kind of like, he's got a bit of an affection for it because it's his, but he doesn't recognize it as his own anymore. And in the meantime, there's this other idea that he's having. And that's what he really wants to do. But he just can't get rid of this damn Gardenback. He's just stuck with it and can't get rid of it. And you can see that in a way as the plot of Eraserhead. He keeps getting, he's stuck with the baby. The baby is in his room. The baby's constantly taking up his attention, stopping him from doing what he wants to do. And at the same time, he's receiving in his pigeonhole a little baby, just the germ of a new idea. And that's what he's really interested in. But when he tries to go down and check his pigeonhole again, his baby cries and stops him going. When he dreams that Mary X produces more fetuses, those aren't the ones he wants anymore, and he smashes them against the wall. I mean, that's I'm certainly that could be one way you could read the kind of thought processes that underlie the narrative in this film. I mean, I guess there's a more straightforward one, which is the one that Jennifer Lynch has advanced, which is not unrelated, actually. Jennifer Lynch says the baby is her. It represents her because she was born with a club foot, and she doesn't quite put it this way, but there's a kind of implication that David Lynch was more interested in the art life than in being a father. Something that I mean, I think Lynch himself kind of acknowledged, he loved having a child, but he didn't really see it as his role to spend any time raising the child. What he was going to do was art. And so therefore that baby is, I don't think it's about Jennifer Lynch, and I don't think it's about David Lynch either, but it's reflecting some thoughts he's having about the nature of paternity and how you reconcile that with the other kind of creativity that he has. And the other kind of creativity is producing not baby children who are human, but producing art, and works from the imagination. And the problem, of course, is that if you do take that reading too literally, it takes you to some really unpleasant places because, the film obviously concludes with him murdering the Peggy figure. I'm not even sure I want to characterize it as murder, and we can maybe get back to that. It's more complicated than that. But turning his back on the Peggy baby figure and actually embracing art at the end, embracing a world of pure imagination, which you can understand if you're Peggy Lynch. Actually, I don't, what am I saying, Peggy Lynch? Jennifer Lynch. Peggy Lynch was his ex-wife. I'm sorry, please forgive me. Jennifer Lynch, his daughter, is who I'm talking about. Yeah, it's not a very flattering or complimentary reading of the film for her. It is, though, I understand how she reads it. So yeah.
And it's interesting to think about it time-wise in terms of sociology and the fact that I think at that moment in time, there was very little discussion of the burden of children and also things about the difficulties of parenting and what people were experiencing, particularly single parents, etc. And I think we're having a lot more open discussions today about those aspects of parenting and how life shifts with children. So it may have been quite a forerunner in that category through the film, if we take that reading literally.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, it's interesting because it shows. I mean, they're both, to start with, he's actually a better parent than the mother is, than Mary X is, I think. Although that said, it is quite clear that Mary X has the greater burden of work, of labor concerning the child. She's at home looking after the child while he sort of swans off somewhere. But she's, I mean, the relationship that she has with Henry is completely loveless. But they have a shotgun wedding, and it's clear that she's not at all interested in him sexually, and doesn't love him. But that's also true about her relationship with the baby. She shouts at it, which is kind of a real taboo, I think. I think that's a very horrifying scene, actually. And she is obviously upset when it doesn't take food from her. And ultimately, she abandons the baby, really. There's no sort of indication that she's coming back, although it's hard to read the chronology of the film because so much of what follows that is a dream. In fact, that might already be part of the scene where she leaves, might already be part of the dream, because he goes to sleep before that in the bed with her. But and he is, I mean, he shows real affection and care for the baby, at least at first. His attitude towards the baby changes, I think, in particular. I mean, you can tell that he's frustrated that he can't go and check his pigeonhole, but I think his attitude really changes when the baby appears to laugh at him, when the baby ridicules him because of his failure to connect to the beautiful girl across the hall. And I think that there's, you sense that there's an element of resentment that comes into their relationship at that point. When he does kill the baby, initially, it seems to be an act of curiosity more than anything else. He gets some scissors, but he doesn't stab the baby. He cuts the swaddling kind of wrap that has covered the baby since it arrived. To anyone who hasn't seen the film, the baby is just basically a head emerging from swaddling clothes. So you never really see its body until the very end of the film when it's opened. And even then, does it have a body, or is it all just appears to be insides? And in fact, if anything, the swaddling bandages were functioning as its skin or as its outside. They were holding it together. And it's only when he cuts it open and realizes that he is looking at its insides, that he stabs at one of the organs, or at two of the organs, with the scissors. But he's obviously both horrified and ashamed by what he's doing, and I think it's just he doesn't know what to do. So I'm not, he does murder the baby. I mean, quite, well, if it were a normal baby, we would say he's murdering the baby. He's performing some kind of symbolic action in this sequence, and it's very hard to know exactly how to read it. But his own reactions aren't the reactions that you would expect of a straightforward infanticide. And of course, the baby doesn't appear to die. It continues living and then transforms into something like the planet. I mean, one of the mysteries of the film is what the baby is, but I think an even bigger mystery is what the planet is, and I don't really know. Although you could argue that they're very closely intertwined mysteries, because the baby and the planet do seem to become one. The planet is not spherical, but kind of egg-shaped, and actually resembles the shape of the baby's head. And in the end, it opens where the baby's mouth opens. And so it's, I wish I had an answer for you as to what exactly the planet is. And I don't know, but it has this weird demiurgic figure inside it who pulls levers and who seems to be manipulating events somehow from outside of the control of Henry, and making Henry's life bad in one way or another.
May I suggest that you just mentioned the fact that the planet is egg-shaped. The way he cuts the baby reminds me of the scene of the chickens at the beginning. He cuts him up like a regular chicken, doesn't he?
And the chickens are man-made, explicitly, right? So whatever that means. So cutting is an essential activity for Henry. It's a kind of defining activity, and it's like erasing. It's what he's done to the photograph. It's what he does at the end to the baby. He's asked to carve the chicken. He never actually gets to carve the chicken. He just sort of sticks the prog in, and it does what it does. But he's supposed to carve the chicken, and really bizarrely, I never really know whether you can take this as a reading of the film because it's something external to the film. But quite famously, when this film had its premiere at Filmex in 1977, Lynch couldn't stay in the theatre because he was so nervous and so upset by the response that he perceived it was getting. So he walked up and down outside the hall like an expectant father, right? It's like this is my baby, and now I'm really worried because it's being delivered for the first time to a public audience. And famously, after that screening, he decided, not quite on a whim, it's a decision he had been reaching, but it was solidified after this screening, immediately after this screening, that he was going to cut 20 minutes from the film. And this is a very similar act of cutting. It's an erasure of part of the film. Famously, those 20 minutes are irrecoverable. There have been hints of what's in them, and there's a few stills and a tiny bit of footage of a cat. But actually, we're never going to see these. And if you look at the closing credits of the film, there's a kind of, in the cast list, there are the ghosts of characters that never actually make it into the final part of the film. So you can tell just from some of the names of this Mr. Roundheels. Well, we don't know who Mr. Roundheels is, but he was clearly a character in the film. There's the man with the cigar. There's the landlady who we never meet.
And
But
Jennifer Lynch herself.
and Jennifer Lynch, and who I think might be someone that we glimpse when he sees the people fighting out the window, but I'm not sure if it is her. It's impossible to tell. No, absolutely. So in a sense, the cutting theme is something that extended into the film's afterlife and has actually become part of the texture of the film that we now know, because bits of it were really quite brutally cut out of the film. He used it from the what's it called, from the composite print. So it was the he cut it in the worst possible way, su such that we will never be able to recover this material. And the chicken scene, I mean the dinner scene, we haven't really talked about the dinner scene at all. It is a moment of extreme awkwardness and discomfort from beginning to end. It's the meet the parents scene, except that what Henry doesn't realize is that he's about to be told he's not just meeting the parents from the girlfriend that he thought had left him already, but that actually he's now a father and he's about to get married to this girlfriend and he doesn't really have any choice in the matter. And this sequence is full of really weird, wrong sexual energy, and also images of birth. Inside their house, there's a dog that's very noisily suckling its puppies, which is obviously prefiguring what his kind of fear of becoming a father and what that's going to involve. The chicken, as you pointed out, although we don't know it yet, actually visually behaves quite similarly to the way that the baby behaves when it's cut. And the mother's reaction to this chicken kind of opening and closing its legs and spurting out fluids is overtly a sexual reaction. She appears to be having a kind of trance-like orgasm. And she then pulls Henry aside, saying that she has something to tell him in private. And having revealed that there's a baby, she says, "You'd better cooperate," and then moves in vampirically, pushing him against the wall and kisses his neck. And it is just like a vampire, which is one of the other reasons that I think of Vampire when I watch this film. And needs, in fact, to be, you know, Henry needs to be rescued by Mary X. And it's just such a, in every respect, such a strange and uncomfortable sequence. Although it is also really funny. And it's really funny primarily because of Bill, who is nothing like the women in the family, who just kind of blunders in, speaks more than anybody else, speaks in kind of non sequiturs, although does reveal that the environment in which they live used to be green pastures and it's now a hellhole, and that's only taken a few decades. So it is a place of decay. And he, there's, in fact, when I mentioned earlier that one of the things I love about the film is the incongruous moods that it presents to you, there's a fantastic image in the dinner sequence where after the chicken has done what it's done and Mary and the mother have rushed into the kitchen, we see Bill just staring at a very uncomfortable Henry and smiling, like grinning with a kind of rictus grin. And he doesn't let up, he just keeps grinning like this is frozen on his face. And as Henry looks at him and the camera looks at him, Mary appears directly behind him looking through the door. So we see the grinning face at the bottom of the screen, and at the top of the screen we see Mary and she's weeping. And this contrast between his facial expression and hers just leaves the viewer not having a clue how they're supposed to respond to this scene. And that's something that for me encapsulates what this whole film does.
Do you think there might be elements here because of the absurdist nature of such moments that one could link with Kafka?
I do. I know, I mean, we know that Lynch liked Kafka. I mean, it's not sort of it's not something that we're imposing on him because he did talk about Kafka. But also I think in this film there are quite direct allusions to Orson Welles' The Trial. In particular the way that the I'd suggested earlier that there are elements in the room that find their way into his dreams, even in sequences that aren't set in the room. And one of those is the railing at the end of the bed. And in one sequence, in fact, as he loses his head, the bed railing appears in front of him, but it's like he's a witness in court. It's like he's on trial in a court with this railing that he's holding onto nervously. Also the fact that the trial is an absurdist prosecution come persecution narrative. It's in monochrome. There's a floozy living next door to the main character. It's very, you know, there are all kinds of little references. And I mean, I know Kafkaesque can be a very loose term, but they're obviously both dealing in a kind of surrealistic experience, is a surrealistic version of the human condition. Oh, I should say this is actually getting back to a question you asked me right at the beginning, but and it's a little hard to approach because I don't normally, when I talk about films, talk personally at all. But one of the other things that has always appealed to me very personally about this film is that there are so many films you see that offer you heroes to identify with, or you know, different figures of identification that you see in various genres. But this is a very rare film that gives you a figure who is just anxiety embodied. And I am a very neurotic person. And so I find his experiences the way I see daily life, basically. And in fact, the only recent film I can think of that's had even a remotely similar effect is, oh gosh, the second last Ari Aster film.
Oh, he's
Oh,
afraid.
Is Afraid, yeah. Where it's just, you have, I mean, you can tell the moment you see Henry and the moment you see that haircut that he has that he does not fit in. And in a way, what we're seeing is an externalization in that haircut of the way he sees himself. And the way he sees himself is as a freak. There's another scene later in the film, very much just actually before he kills the baby, when he opens the door to try to intercept the beautiful girl across the hall, and she turns and looks at him, and she sees the baby's head where his head should be. Like she just sees a big baby, which in many ways is what he is in the film. But the fact that he projects that, because it then cuts back and he doesn't have the baby's head, but that's a projection of the way that he feels about himself, I think. And that he does feel like a freak, and he feels anxious, and he feels that he doesn't fit in. And I personally just find it really gratifying to see a film where I think, oh, I know exactly what this feels like, and this is our and I, you know, I don't think that I'm alone in this. And I, you know, I don't think it's an accident that this is a film which has always, you know, this film showed at Filmex not successfully. It had a review in Variety that was really a very destructive review, but was picked up by Barinholtz for the New York Midnight Circuit. And Barinholtz, I believe, had only seen one reel of it when he made the selection, but I mean, but knew what he was doing and knew the audience, because that's the audience of misfits and freaks. And it found its audience really readily, and it found, you know, like all great midnight movies, it found a repeat audience, people that would not just watch it, but they would come back and they'd watch it again and again. It's just really reassuring to see that this is a type of human experience not very often depicted in film, that's here writ large. It's strange though, because when you see Lynch interviewed, he never comes across as a particularly anxious or nervous person. He comes across as actually quite confident and quite happy in his skin. And so I don't really know where it comes from, but boy, does he know how to present it. And I think that is why, I think it's that sense of constant anxiety that is why so many people categorize this film as horror, because they don't know how else to deal with that particular vibe.
And I think it's a film that requires a lot of interpretation from the audience, which is rare to a certain extent with traditional films, where there's a narrative that is ongoing, but that you just follow along. Whereas here, you really have to be active as an audience member to try to make sense of what's happening in front of you. And that, I suppose that can be unsettling for some people.
Absolutely. Unsettling, because there's no easy answers. It's like you're just lost and you're stuck and you've got to do something with what's being thrown at you. From beginning to end, there is a through line, and it's one of these films where if you were to say to me, can I summarize the plot? I probably could do, and I probably could do in two sentences. But I'd be aware in doing so that I'd be probably ignoring everything that's important in the film, because every moment actually counts and contributes. And Henry's little through line, if you ignore all the dreams he has, I mean, for example, we haven't really talked about the lady in the radiator at all. We haven't talked about the fact that she appears in a theatre that is behind his radiator, but that's in his imagination. We haven't talked about the fact that she sings and dances, and that she's a performer whose performance is interrupted by fetuses falling onto the stage. These are the kinds of things, if you're summarizing the film, that aren't going to make it into your summary, because how could they? But actually, they're all crucially important, I think, insofar as everything in the film is crucially important, because you are stuck with piecing together disparate scenes and different pieces of information, and also different kind of musical cues. The soundtrack is ex is I think there had never actually, before this film was made, been a soundtrack quite like this. It's Alan Splet and David Lynch's. I mean, Alan Splet had worked on The Grandmother with David Lynch, and in fact, I think it's because of his work on The Grandmother that he got a job at the AFI, being in charge of the sound department. And he then worked very closely with David Lynch over a year in post-production doing the soundtrack. And it's not a score as such. There's a lot of Fats Waller incorporated into it, and there is a song which appears at one point in the film. But apart from that, what you have is layerings of industrial sounds and weird found sounds and a lot of distorted or processed sounds. And they're all layered on top of one another, and they're omnipresent. A lot of them are subliminal. You don't notice them, but they definitely affect your mood as you're watching the film. A lot of kind of sub-bass sounds as well. And the sound of factories, and it I think that it's a way of constructing a soundtrack that actually now we take for granted in a lot of films. But I'm struggling to think of a film before Eraserhead that used this. It's very, very innovative. It's not the sounds of birds singing. I mean, this is not a, it's not like the introduction to Blue Velvet where you're given a kind of idyllic world. It's all the, you know, the sounds of rain and the sounds of wind are actually serving to make the tiny hermetic world of his apartment seem constantly oppressed by the outside world. And I mean, you know, one of the details I love is when you look out his window, you literally see a brick wall. It's like that's his view. And even the interiors of his flat are, you know, there's the mound of dirt with the tree, which we've discussed earlier, but there's also on his dresser this big mound of dirt. I don't really know what it's doing there. When he opens one of his drawers, there's a pot of water in it for no obvious reason. There was a scene that was actually cut from the film, so it's not in the film, but where there was a drawer full of porridge with peas in it. I don't really know what that was doing either. And although he finds the most comfort in his apartment, that's also the source of all his nightmares, and the nightmares that reflect that in that immediate environment. I one of the stories I love about the production of the film is that I think about 9 months into the production, a very significant date, given a very significant number, I guess, given that this is a film about birth. But 9 months into the production, he separated from his wife Peggy, and then divorced her formally. And he had nowhere to live, and he had no money. So for really quite a long time, I think for over a year, he secretly lived in the stables where they were shooting the film. Now the stables on AFI's property were they consisted of several rooms, and some of them were used as production rooms. And then there's the sets, you know, there were that there's the bedroom primarily. And it's just such a strange thing to imagine that David Lynch, as well as making this film all night, the shoot was almost all done at night. We can talk about that as well if you like, but he was sleeping in that room. He was spending all of his sleeping time. Actually, it's almost like an it's like what the I think the Romans called the ritual of incubation, you know, where you take on the dreams of a place. So that, you know, in many ways, it's such a willful identification of himself with the protagonist of the film. Given that the bed is the key location, I think, for Henry. Henry spends most of the film asleep, really. That's actually not true at all. It's only about 20 minutes of the film, but it's a substantial portion of the film. And he also spends a lot of time lying on the bed or sitting on the bed. And I love the fact that the bed, which really ought to be the place where he's most comfortable, we see in a later scene that all the blanket is kind of has all these tears in it, and it's where he nervously scrapes his fingers along it because he's a fiddler, because he's so uptight and anxious all the time. And he also tears at the nap of his pajamas, of his pajama pants. These are all kind of signifiers of his constant sense of anxiety, even when he's in the one place where that's a haven for him, that's a kind of haven of security for him.
And I love the transformation scene when the bed becomes this kind of almost volcanic, marshy landscape that I always saw as kind of a coming to life reflection of the small mound on his bedside table. But I'm not sure if that's correct because the landscape is slightly different. But nonetheless, what do you think of this scene? This is when the neighbor comes to
The
spend.
seduction scene, where his the beautiful girl from across the hall knocks on his door at night. And she more or less invites herself in, and it's quite clear that she's seducing him and wants to have sex with him. And he's embarrassed by the presence of the baby and tries to shush it up because it's crying and he doesn't want her to see the baby as a part of his life. And then when they, it's clearly a representation of them having sex, but it's presented in a very oblique fashion. You see them sinking together into a pool that's in the center of his bed. Well, it's a wet dream. That's his wet dream, and literally wet. And I think it's just after that sequence that the In Heaven, Everything Is Fine song appears, where he's sort of had his moment of escape. That's his, he's reaching bliss. And that's the first scene where he is shown the kind of light that the lady in the radiator has to offer. Although for whatever reason, it doesn't seem that he's quite ready for it yet. It is a really strange sequence where the lady in the radiator is singing on stage. And he just suddenly steps onto the stage, and it's like this real, it's like a transgression in of the space that you would expect him to occupy and this space that she occupies, which never really, he never seems to belong to. But suddenly there he is right in front of her, and she welcomes him. But it's not his time. His time isn't till the end of the film, although why that's his time is not really, to me, entirely clear. In the sense that it's up shortly after that that he'll lose his head, I think that's the sequence. And it's only after he's killed the baby and the man in the planet has had his last pulls with the levers that suddenly, without any explanation, Henry appears to be in a heavenly place. He's showered in light. And he embraces the lady in the radiator. And I might add that the opening image of the film, although it does seem to be introducing a dream, in the opening image of the film of of Henry's floating head, his eyes are open. But at the end of the film, his eyes are shut, and that's what the camera focuses on. And they're shut in kind of ecstasy. It's the first time, it's the only time in the film that he looks calm. When he's in the embrace of her, but it's a strangely it's not like, it's certainly not like the embrace, the forced embrace that he has with Mary X's mother. And it's not even like the embrace he has with the beautiful girl from across the road, which is across the hall, which is purely sexual and also awkward because of the baby's presence. And it's not really sexual. It's, it doesn't seem to me to be very sexual. It's just comfort and warmth. And I guess, given that she occupies the radiator, that is what we would expect her to provide. She's kind of, she seems to symbolize that, but I don't know what she symbolizes, but it's the sort of escapist, pure idea that's unencumbered by all the things that have been burdening him throughout the film, which are things from his past that he's wanted to put behind him. I know some people think that he's dead at the end of the film, which is entirely possible. I don't know. But they're,
I would argue that for Lynch, death is something relative anyway, so it doesn't really matter. It's not an absolute. But earlier on, you were mentioning the absence of birds. Bird singing, the presence of nature, the wind, the water, but no birds. And I was wondering if one couldn't, to a certain extent, understand the lady in the radiator as a bird of sorts. She's behind the radiator that looks very much like a cage. She sings like a bird. I don't know. I mean, is that totally crazy from
No,
me?
not at all. No, I like that idea. I like it a lot. And I'm just thinking the, I think the only animals we hear in the film are dogs, and they're barking aggressively at him. I mean, they're you know, they're frightening. It's not a nice sound. No, I like the idea that that she's a singing bird. And I mean, just the fact that she sings, it's so, it's such an unexpected moment. You know, the film is a musical. We don't really think of it, but it has a moment that's it's intradiegetic, it's unmotivated, it's just a character bursts into song. So yeah, I think that's entirely possible.
But it's interesting too to think about this absence of animals due to the baby's physical appearance, which we know is rumored to be some sort of dead animal carcass around which the baby's been made. So I don't know what you see when you look at the baby, but the rumors that it's possibly a dead rabbit or lamb, that makes a lot of sense to me when I see it.
There's also that story about the cat. I mean, there's this story that he's told many times about how he asked a vet for a cat that had recently died, which he then dissected and was looking at its sort of the materiality of its interior. And there was, he said that there are various points in the film where the cat was used, but he can't really say when, and they had to, and he made an agreement with the vet that it had to be unrecognizable. And we know because it actually exists, and it's like it's as an extra on one of on his DVD. That we know that there was a sequence cut from the film where Henry prods at a cat that's dead on the ground, which will have been that cat. I don't know. I do know that David Lynch has been asked many times about how he realized the baby. And this has been one of those questions that he has repeatedly refused to answer in any way. He's always been very kind of enigmatic about it. Now, I'm not an expert in special effects, and so I can only relate to you something that a friend once told me who is an expert in special effects. This is someone I know in Australia who has worked on some of the Matrix films and does and works precisely on modeling. And he just said he never understood what the fuss was about. It's really straight. To him, it just looked like a very straightforward prop. You know, it's latex and some other stuff, and it's not very complicated. But that's not actually answering the question of how it's done. But I think it's possible. I don't know. Maybe there's organic matter in there as well. I don't know.
The nose that gets to me.
It's I mean, the movement of the eye is amazing, although that actually reflects the movement of Henry's eyes when he's trying to sleep in bed. It's like there's a definite echo of the two. I mean, in many ways, I guess that baby has been kind of influential because you can see it in E.T. and you can see it in Basket Case. You can see it in a whole bunch of films that followed. It's so funny to think that E.T. has a connection to Eraserhead, I think. But I mean, that's one of the other things. I suggested that I think the beginning alludes to 2001: A Space Odyssey, and Kubrick declared Eraserhead to be one of his favorite films. We know that George Lucas liked it because that was related to David Lynch being offered Return of the directing of Return of the Jedi. Obviously, Mel Brooks liked it. I mean, there's some very. It's not the usual suspects that have been drawn to this film. A lot of very prominent but quite mainstream directors or directors who just work in completely different genres. I mean, Mel Brooks was instrumental in David Lynch getting to direct The Elephant Man, and that was entirely on the basis of Eraserhead. And I just think, who would ever have guessed that Mel Brooks would love Eraserhead? It's such a. I mean, I'm delighted that he did, but it's just not the leap I would have made.
The story is, he came out of the cinema just after having seen Eraserhead, and he said, "That guy is crazy. I want him to
It's my guilt. I'm not even sure I should say this in public, but it's my guilty secret that I've never actually liked Elephant Man. I know that it's a lot of people's favorite Lynch film, but I just have never got on with it. I like the industrial mood of it, which is obviously very similar to Eraserhead, but I just find it over melodramatic and
Well, you'd
a
already
little too Dickensian for my tastes, I think.
experienced the makeup of the woman in the radiator, so there you go.
Who do you think today still makes movies that are reminiscent of Eraserhead? Or is it just something that has not really directly linked or led to a similar form of cinema?
Gosh. All right, let me just think. I think that you could argue that there's a line that could be drawn between Eraserhead and some of the filmmakers working in body horror today, although I don't really think that David Lynch invented body horror, and I clearly don't think they're the only person from that period who was inspired. I mean, obviously David Cronenberg is having a massive influence as well. But I mean, I think you could see that there's some connection between what Lynch was doing here and some body horror. I've always thought that there's a loose subgenre that includes films like actually David Cronenberg's Spider, that I would call the muttering man film. I mean, David Lynch likes making films about women in trouble, the woman in trouble. But Eraserhead is his muttering man film. And I think it's possibly one of the first muttering man films. And there's not a huge tradition of them, but there's quite a lot of them that have been made since. There's a film called Alois that I think is not dissimilar. I mean, you definitely say that. Combat Shock directly alludes to Eraserhead, although Combat Shock is not a new film. So you really asked about new filmmakers. I mean, I've always thought the film that's most influenced actually by Eraserhead is Barton Fink. not just because of the appearance of the main character, but also because it's set in LA, which arguably Eraserhead is, so I'm not entirely sure. It's certainly the outdoor scenes in Eraserhead, the scenes shot during the daytime are LA, and they're recognizably LA. It contains one line that is a quote from Eraserhead, which is, "Did you have sexual intercourse?"
It's also about creation, isn't
Well,
it?
that's just it. It's about the creative process and someone who is blocked and someone who is being held back and who is trying to kind of birth this new mutant work. I mean, that's always struck me as the film that most intelligently engages with what Eraserhead has to offer. I think there's quite a few films. I mean, something like Combat Shock very directly alludes to Eraserhead, but I don't think it's a dynamic allusion. I think it's just a, I think Eraserhead is cool type of allusion. I'm just trying to think if there are. I mean, I guess Beau is Afraid has aspects of Eraserhead to it, because that's again a film where there's no indication of where the dream starts or ends. It just seems constantly to be a really, really anxious dream, from a very male perspective. But there's other things going on in that film as well, and I think the mother angle doesn't really come into Eraserhead at all. And I mean, obviously the Jewish neurosis doesn't come into Eraserhead at all either. I'm trying to think of films now that there was a film. I'm embarrassed that I can't remember the name of the director, but there was a film that came out recently called Abruptio, which is presented with life-size puppets. So the whole film is all the characters in it are human-sized puppets, and in that are and that's got a very similar vibe to Eraserhead. Absolutely filled with anxiety, and where it's hard to get a kind of grip on where the anchoring reality of the film is and how much of it is just in the mind of the protagonist, who's male as well. But I think that, I mean, there's lots of people that try to imitate Lynch, but I'm not really so sure that it ever gets much further than just being surreal, which is a very kind of broad category.
But it's already a very rich answer. And I just wanted to take a moment to come back to what you said about Kubrick and his appreciation for Eraserhead, because we have had an episode of the podcast dedicated to The Shining, and allegedly he asked all of the cast members to watch Eraserhead before they began working on the film. I can't verify that information, but it's out there.
That's amazing. I mean, I wonder why. But then, for the same reason that I kind of wonder why Lynch asked the entire cast to watch Sunset Boulevard, where, and even he's admitted there's no direct link. It's just the mood. Although, again, like Barton Fink, a film about kind of old world fallen Hollywood, and the creative process. So I don't know.
I was just thinking about the ending of Eraserhead and the extent to which it somehow came back over and over again in the films of Lynch, if I'm correct. You know, this meeting of Henry and Mary. You've got a similar scene at the end of Wild at Heart when Sailor and Lula are on, alone together above the cars. At the end of Eraserhead, you've got the two main characters who are in the sky above Los Angeles. It seems to me that this is a recurring motif, isn't it? This somehow transcendental afterlife somehow for the characters.
Yeah, I think Lynch just really likes. I mean, Lynch is—he's always characterized as being this very dark director, and I mean, I think that's a completely reasonable characterization. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But I think he likes gifting. I don't know whether it's gifting his audience or whether it's just gifting his characters with a kind of a happy ending. And this, even if it's absurdly framed, the notion that their love wins through.
It's given.
And and that there's good and there's heaven and all the these kind of bromides of reassurance about the world. They sort of I mean, I do think they're kind of they are kind of funny though, because they're always framed as being absurd. So I mean, in a way, it's hard to know whether they seem they're presented in such an aw shucks sincere way, but at the same time, they do seem to be just lampooning a Hollywood way of telling a story by just sort of imposing for no reason this Hollywood ending. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, maybe it isn't imposing because he is consistent in that across his work. Yeah, maybe it just reflects the way he thinks. I mean, there is something kind of charming about the way that from all this darkness you emerge into light, right? So yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention about Eraserhead? I have the feeling we could discuss the film for hours, and I know there are probably many aspects we haven't touched upon yet, but is there one thing that you really hold on to that you'd like to mention that we haven't addressed yet, or maybe a word about a word to those who haven't seen the film yet, who are going to discover it for the first time in 2025?
I would say if you haven't seen the film yet, even if you've heard a lot about it and read a lot about it, you are in a unique and enviable position, because this film is going to do things to you that you're not expecting, because it is an experience as a film. It takes you on a very peculiar journey where you will never really be able to predict where it's going. And it will make you feel very, very odd emotions that you feel are somehow wrong all the time. So, I mean, in a way, that first viewing, the film certainly crystallizes itself in all kinds of ways if you watch it more than once. But there's something just perfect about that first viewing because of the confusion and disorientation that you're going to experience.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for this
Thank you
discussion.
very much.
It
Thank
was
you.
wonderful to chat with you tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.